We are continuing our discussion of the topic of apologetics, and actually going to, for the first time this evening, begin to make some positive arguments, or at least give examples of evidences with regard to the inspiration of the Bible. So we have kind of got through the introductory material with regard to the study of apologetics. We have also spent some time defining what we mean by Bible inspiration and discussing some of the claims that the Bible has made concerning the fact that it is inspired. And we're going to this evening begin discussing some of the arguments. And I do want to just make note of what we ended up with. We rushed through them very, very quickly. Just want to make note again so that we're very clear about it, what we're claiming with regard to inspiration. In the contrast, what we talk about when we talk about Bible inspiration just might give you an example of the false claim of inspiration, that which is made by the Mormons with regard to the Book of Mormon. Those of you who might be familiar with Mormon theology are aware of the fact that Joseph Smith claimed that the translation of the Book of Mormon was an inspired translation. That he had been guided by God to translate the plates that contained the original language, and I don't remember what language that was purported to be, but those plates that he supposedly put into his hat and looked into his hat and received the translation from God, that translation is supposed to itself be inspired of God. And when you talk about inspiration, as we have defined inspiration to be, that which is without error, that which is perfect, then if you claim that a translation is inspired, or maybe the copies themselves of the original autographs are inspired, then the claim would be invalidated if errors could be seen in the translation or in the copies. And that, of course, is the case with regard to the Book of Mormon. You can actually get earlier editions of the Book of Mormon and find many grammatical errors, grammatical mistakes, passages that were included that have been since taken out, other passages that have been altered in newer editions. In other words, many, many changes from the original edition of the Book of Mormon, which indicates that there have been errors and omissions and changes and those kinds of things in that in what was supposed to be an inspired translation. Well, when we talk about inspiration, what we're talking about is the original manuscripts that were written by the apostles and other writers of the Bible, from Moses with regard to the Pentateuch all the way to John with regard to the Book of Revelation. And these men wrote these words down. They did not do so by their own will, but they did so as they were moved by the Holy Spirit. And so those original documents were inspired in the original language when it was first written. And multitudes of copies have been made over the centuries, and as a result of that, there are some errors that have crept into some of the copies. When we will talk about textual criticism and the idea of how we got the Bible in later lessons, we'll deal with those particular issues. We're not claiming that every copy that was written down of those original manuscripts is inspired. But we do believe and contend that the methods that were used to produce the modern Bible has given us an accurate, reliable copy of the original autographs. In other words, that we have been able to reconstruct with accuracy the text of the Old Testament and the text of the New Testament in the original language. So there is Hebrew, there is the Greek language, and a bit of Aramaic, the three languages in which the Bible was written, primarily Hebrew and Greek, and those have been reconstructed accurately. It's not to say that there are not some issues that we have to deal with as we discuss how we got the Bible and those original or those copies of the original autographs, but it is an accurate representation of those things so that we can know the name of God and the will of God. The third point up on the board is that we do not believe the translations to be inspired. I was talking with John Isaac Edwards at lunch today. He's the one that's holding the meeting at Woodmont, the preacher there. And it was either him or perhaps it was Bruce Tilley. I can't remember who was making this point. It was Bruce that was doing it. A member there at Woodmont. was referring to a place that they had visited up in the Northeast, very rural area, and there was, let's say, not a group of individuals not highly educated. I don't remember exactly where it was, which state it was. I wouldn't want to say because it might offend someone, but these individuals that spend their entire life up on a mountain and have never come down other than maybe to go to Walmart, and that's about as far as it's gone. But you remember talking to one of them. You can ask him. He's here tonight, so you can ask him what they meant. I can't remember, but anyway, he was talking to them, and they mentioned that they appreciated most the King James translation of the Bible, and when he asked why that was the case, he said because that's the way they spoke back then. In other words, that translation is the way they spoke back in the first century. Of course, that's an indication of quite severe ignorance. That was the King's English in the 1600s, not back in the first century when they spoke Greek. But having said that, there are individuals who will basically say that the King James Version is the only acceptable version. It's the authorized version, as if it's authorized by God. The reference to authorized version means the King James authorized it. Not that it is divinely authorized. But there are individuals who actually will claim that the Bible, the only translation that is acceptable in the King James Version of the Bible. Now, there are some translations that are not as good as others, but the point that I want to make here is that the translations themselves are not inspired. Having said that, we do want to remember that Jesus and the apostles quoted from a translation. The Greek Septuagint version, translation of Hebrew Scriptures, that's a Greek translation of Hebrew Scriptures, was what was commonly in use in the first century. And when Jesus and the disciples quoted from Old Testament Scripture, they were often quoting from that Greek translation, which would be a very similar use of a translation of the Bible that we do every day as we read our English Bibles. So we're not claiming that the translations are inspired. However, we do claim that they give us God's divine will, that the translators have done a sufficiently good job to give us the meaning of the word so that it can be understood in our language and God's divine will can be known. So the only other point, the fourth point, and again, these are some things that we'll talk about in more detail as we get into the textual criticism, how we got the Bible and such, is we affirm. And I recognize that this affirmation is not something that is going to prove to anyone who's not a Christian that the Bible is dependable. But it is a logical progression. If we believe that the Bible is divinely inspired and consists of God's will for man, and by that, the will that God intended for man to know, then it stands to reason that as God authored it, God will preserve it. And so we assert that providentially, with God's help, that original message, as it was penned over a period of hundreds of years, in 66 books, two covenants, that we can know that today. So those are the affirmations that we make, the assertions that we make with regard to inspiration. So that gets us to the first argument that we're going to be making. And basically, the evidences that we're going to supply in this particular part of our study are fourfold. We're going to be talking about historical and factual accuracy. And we'll explain what we mean by that in just a moment. And I think that's a pretty big one. It's a pretty helpful one. Secondly, we're going to spend a little time talking about scientific foreknowledge. And what we mean by that are certain things that the Bible writes about with regard to the condition of man, with regard to the state of the universe, with regard to health issues, things like that, that stand in contrast to the ignorance and superstition that would be prevalent at that time and show themselves to be technically and scientifically accurate. From more recent discoveries, which would indicate, again, inspiration behind the message. And we'll talk about that a bit more as we get into it. The third area that we're going to discuss in this booklet is fulfilled prophecy. That's another big one that we'll spend some time discussing. And then the fourth one that I just want to touch upon is the concept of uniformity in purpose and teaching. That the way in which the Bible is constructed, the scheme of redemption that runs as a scarlet thread from the book of Genesis to the book of Revelation, the way in which it It details and establishes for us the things that are needful for man, but all of these are an argument as to its inspiration. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we get there. But I want you to notice under the caption, historical and factual accuracy, is that if we are claiming that the Bible is inspired, then the historical and geographical references that are contained in the book, that those things are accurate. In other words, if God said such and such happened at such and such place, then that's exactly what happened and where it happened. When you recognize there are individuals today that claim that that when David lived, that Israel was not a kingdom. That the culture and the people and the government was not sufficiently organized to be declared a kingdom, and so what we have is basically fiction that is written with regard to David, with regard to Solomon, so on and so forth. Individuals who claim that that is the case. Individuals will claim, for example, that Moses could not have written the Pentateuch because at the time in which Moses lived, writing had not yet been invented. And so it would have been impossible for Moses to have written the book. There's a lot of claims that are made like this. And if those are legitimate claims, then they do cast a doubt concerning the veracity of our claims of inspiration. We alluded to this a number of weeks ago, using again the Book of Mormon as an example, that while the Book of Mormon cannot be verified archaeologically, in other words, the peoples and the cultures and the locations that are found in the Book of Mormon cannot be verified by archaeological means. You can't go to that particular location and dig up stoneware or pottery or uncover documents or anything like that to verify the claims that are made in the Book of Mormon. That in fact, the Bible has shown itself to be a very helpful archaeological guide as individuals have gone to the Bible lands and they have sought to locate and to verify the events, whether it be the existence of civilizations such as the Hittites, or the location of certain cities such as Jericho, or particular events that may have been found in Scripture. Now, we're going to look at, in our first example, with regard to the Hezekiah's tunnel, a discovery that took place in 1838. And the way in which this individual discovered this particular tunnel was because of what he was looking at in the Bible. We read 2 Kings 20:20, Hezekiah made a tunnel, and he diverted water. And so he said, well, I'm going to find that. And he did. He was going to find that. We'll look a little bit about Hezekiah's tunnel as we get into this particular study. But there are a couple of things that we need to recognize in this regard. When we say the claim of inspiration requires that all verifiable historical details be found accurate, the key word there is verifiable. We need to recognize that secular history and archaeology cannot verify every single biblical detail. And just as an example is the Hittite civilization, which for a long, long while, many Bible historians and archaeologists or those who were had a critical eye toward biblical archaeology, they believed that the Bible was inaccurate, that this was a people that did not exist. And the reason for that is because there was no evidence as to its existence. In other words, nothing had been uncovered through archaeology to verify the story of the Bible. So I want you to recognize that a lack of evidence cannot be construed as a contradiction of what the Bible reveals. Now, this is a common practice, but it's simply not valid. Just because evidence has not yet been uncovered does not mean the evidence does not exist, or that even it didn't happen. What we're looking for in this regard are any contradictions, any inaccuracies. And so if there is no evidence, that doesn't mean it didn't happen. It simply means that no evidence has been uncovered. There are discoveries that are being made all of the time. Every time a new dig is started, some new discovery is found. And that's true with regard to biblical archaeology. It's with regard to the discoveries with regard to the ancient Greeks or the ancient Romans or going back in time to, you know, the Mesopotamia, places like that. Even with regard to natural paleontology, with regard to the uncovering of fossil evidence of new species of animals and dinosaurs and those kinds of things. There are things that are in the ground yet that we haven't uncovered yet, and until we uncover them, or if we ever uncover them, then we don't have the information. So a lack of evidence is not a contradiction. However, when there is evidence that is uncovered, does that evidence corroborate if it has its application to the biblical story? Does it corroborate or contradict the story? Now, there is one other point to be made in this regard, and that is that we're talking here about actual evidence, not interpretations of the evidence. And this is a very real key, and it's a very real problem that we'll come across time and again in our discussion of these matters, where individuals will take data or evidence and they will say, this is what the evidence means, where we might take the same exact data and say that the evidence means something entirely different. And you can't always do that, understand that, and sometimes it's invalid to do that, but it is a common thing to take some very rudimentary thing. You take as an example, is it Piltdown Man, I believe it was, that turned out to be the hoax? And here's a piece of bone, a jawbone, and the jawbone is taken, and an archaeology now, so I knew that wouldn't correct. But a paleontologist took it, he interpreted it, and said, this is an example of an ancient type of pre-Homo sapien man, and it turned out that it was a pig's bone. Now, again, it was a hoax. In other words, they fooled him, and they fooled a lot of people for a lot of time. But that man was in textbooks for a number of years. And I'm not saying that every single discovery is that way. What I'm saying is people can take a small amount of data and make a claim or an interpretation concerning that data that may very well conflict with what the Bible teaches. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're right and the Bible's wrong. And so we have to be very careful in regard to an examination of these things. So the first thing that I want to do this evening, before we get into a discussion of Hezekiah's tunnel, is to look at one other example. This is an example of a papyrus that was basically just discovered last month. Now, it's a papyrus that is about 1,500 years old. So it's a very, very old papyrus, and it's been in John Ryland's library since 1901. So this is often what happens. The Vaticanus and Sinaiticus manuscripts, those big, almost complete manuscripts of the Bible that were found fairly recently, well, they had been in existence for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, just stuck in the back of some monastery in a cardboard box, you know, that kind of thing that happened. In fact, with regard to one of those two manuscripts, I can't remember what it was, leaves were being torn out and thrown into the fire for fuel for the fire. When a particular researcher came across those and, you know, put it to a stop, or else it would have been lost entirely. But this is an example of that. It had been in the library since 1901, and it's not until 2014 that someone was just going through those old papers and such, and they came across this particular papyrus fragment. Now, what the fragment is purported to be is, as indicated in the text that is up on the bottom part of the slide, a text which was probably inscribed by a monk or a priest to protect the bearer from any kind of evil. This piece of papyrus would have been folded or suspended around their neck, either just with string or a nice locket. Okay, so we'll... how do they know that it's that? In fact, I'll give you a quote from Roberta Mazza, who's the one who found it. She said, it's one of the first recorded documents to use magic in the Christian context. The first charm ever found to refer to the Eucharist, the Last Supper, as the manna of the Old Testament. So this is an interpretation that she has put upon it. What she came across was basically a piece of paper that had been folded, that on one side had this handwritten text, and on the other side it had a receipt on it. It was a receipt concerning some grain tax that had been paid. This is discovered. It is from Egypt. And so it was discovered in again, 1,500 years, so we're talking about 600 AD. So it's very, very ancient. Well, one of the things that was present in Egypt at that time was the wearing of charms around the neck to ward off evil spirits. That's something that was characteristic of that culture at that time. And so this individual, because this is a small piece of paper that had been folded, believes it to have been worn probably in a charm, in a little amulet around the neck, or at least have a string tied around it to ward off evil spirits. So basically, the Christians there had taken on some of the superstitions. Well, is there something in the text that would indicate that? Something that is found in the paper itself to indicate it? I'm going to read to you, and I wish I'd put it up there, but I didn't think to till this afternoon after it was too late. This is what the text of the papyrus reads. It's a fairly small piece of paper. It says, "Fear you all who rule over the earth, know you nations and peoples that Christ is our God. For he spoke and they came to being, he commanded and they were created. He put everything under our feet and delivered us from the wish of our enemies. Our God prepared a sacred table in the desert for the people and gave manna of the new covenant to eat, the Lord's immortal body and the blood of Christ poured for us in remission of sins." Now that's the entirety of the text that's found on that document. I know it's not great, just not quite bright enough, but that's what's on that document. And it was folded. Now, so what is known is the relative age of the manuscript. There is a reference which seems, though it's language that is foreign to Scripture, certainly, and foreign to our way of thinking, it seems to refer in that last paragraph to the Lord's Supper. On the other side of the paper, there is a receipt paid for grain tax. It's almost unreadable. That's another thing that we know. Since it was almost unreadable, the text on the inside would have been this text, because it was more protected, and so it is more readable. And it was folded. And that's all that we know. That's all that is known about that. Where it was, about the time that it was, it's a little folded piece of paper when you read the text. The speculation is that most probably a monk or a priest wrote it. Okay? The second thing is that the purpose of writing the passage was mimicking the Egyptian practice of having an amulet or charm to ward off evil spirits or evil powers. And the third supposition is that it was probably worn around the neck, that there was probably a string that was tied to it, or it was worn in an amulet, when there was no string or amulet that was a part of it, no indication, physical indication of that at all. So you see the difference between speculation, what we know and what we don't know, and the discourse. And the interesting thing about this, as I came across this, I just thought, I want to look into this and read it. This happened just a couple of weeks ago. And, of course, I was already working on some of the material, and I thought this might be something that would be interesting to talk to. But that's what was amazing to me, is that as it was reported as an important archaeological discovery, it was reported in the popular press without any examination of the assertions made, or the speculations. You know, a 6th or 7th century Christian charm uncovered in John Ryland's library, and how this is an important find, and all that. But it was all accepting the speculations that really had absolutely no basis other than the general location. You will remember, by the way, that the Jews were very... a characteristic of the Jews was the writing of the scriptures and putting them on the persons to keep the word of God close to them as a devotional thing. Maybe that's what whoever this is was doing. This afternoon I was studying and I looked down under here and I pulled out this particular sheet of paper that I had written on. And the difference between this one and this one is no one could read my writing. And so they would say there's an idiot wrote some gibberish, you know, 2,000 years ago and we don't know what for. But when I wrote it and I look back on it, I remember we were talking about the Antichrist in a class, a previous class of what is the Antichrist. And I just scribbled down a few thoughts, disjointed thoughts about that. What would happen if this were to be discovered, you know, 1,000 years from now? and people were to look at that and try to, from that, establish a narrative as to what must have been going through my mind, or who I was, or how I utilized it, or the purpose of it. It was just scribble on notepads all at once. And yet, there are individuals who take that kind of thing, and they make this narrative out of it. And that's the point that I want to raise in that regard. Now, we can do the same thing, by the way, and we're just as guilty as they if we do that, of taking advantage of the text. Or the discovery for our own purposes. We need to be careful not to do that either. But this can happen, and I want you to recognize that is the case, and some of the objections that we might come across later we'll have to deal with it and see whether there is any validity or veracity to those claims that are being made. Okay, so with that aside, we get into the Hezekiah's tunnel. Anybody want to comment and questions about what we've looked at so far? All right, well, let us then look at the first example. This picture up on the screen is a picture of Hezekiah's tongue. It's not, like I said, it's hard to see it well, but there are a couple things I want you to know here. Number one, the width of the tunnel is about shoulder width. For the entire 1,700 feet that tunnel travels, often 130 foot below the surface of the ground. This is a tunnel. And by the way, you can go there. It's in pretty much bedrock. It's not going to fall in on your heads, and they let people walk through the tunnel. So it ranges from a place where you have to kind of bend over to get into. So it's pretty claustrophobic, all the way up to 17 foot tall in certain areas. And in the bottom of the tunnel, about this deep throughout the tunnel, is fresh spring water from the Gihon Spring, or Gihon. I'm not sure how it's pronounced. I'll pronounce it Gihon unless somebody tells me I'm wrong. Gihon Spring. And that's from a Hebrew word that means gushing. So this was a spring that welled up from the ground. And this tunnel, so that's the physical dimensions of the tunnel. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we look at some of the evidence and some of the things that surround its discovery and such. But the first thing I want you to do is go with me to 2 Chronicles chapter 32. Actually, the third bullet point up on the slide, that the water source enabled the Jews to withstand the siege. Now that's true. And the diversion, diverting of the water, it was a water source for the city in the midst of the siege when King Sennacherib came and he laid siege to the city of Jerusalem. Again, that was an awful long time ago. That was about. Eighth century BC. So we're talking about a long, long time ago that this tunnel was made. But having said that, the text of 2 Chronicles chapter 32 actually describes a more straightforward reason for what Hezekiah did that is found in verse 3 of the text. Let's start with verse 1 and go down through about verse 8. He said, "After these deeds of faithfulness, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and entered Judah and encamped against the fortified cities, thinking to win them over to himself. When Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib had come, that his purpose was to make war against Jerusalem, he consulted with his leaders and commanders to stop the water from the springs, which were outside the city, and they helped him. Thus many people gathered together who stopped all the springs and the brook that ran through the land, saying, 'Why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water?' And he strengthened himself, built the wall that was broken, raised it up to the tower, built another wall outside, also repaired the mill in the city of David, made weapons and shields in abundance. He sent military captains over the people, gathered them together in the open square of the city gate, gave them encouragement, saying, 'Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid nor dismayed before the king of Assyria, nor before all the multitude that is with him, for there are more with us than with him. With him is an arm of flesh, but with us is the Lord our God to help us and to fight our battles.' And the people were strengthened by the words of Hezekiah, king of Judah." And we'll talk about, as we get into this discussion in a few moments, verses 9 and following, the challenge of Sennacherib and what actually happened as a part of the siege. But the preparatory actions of Hezekiah in regard to this as the inevitability of Sennacherib's siege came about. are indicated in verses 3 and 4 of the text. And I want you to notice, if you go over to the 30th verse, the 30th verse of 2 Chronicles 32, he describes it, the same Hezekiah stopped the water outlet of the upper Gihon and brought the water by tunnel to the west side of the city of David. And Hezekiah prospered in all his works. Now you look at that language. If we can go to the city of Jerusalem and we can find a spring, and then we can go to the west side of the city and we can find water there, perhaps. Or even simply looking at the west side of the city, perhaps we can find evidence of that tunnel that was built. Well, again, there was an American by the name of Edward Robinson, who was not an archaeologist per se, but was a biblical scholar, who decided he was going to try to find this guy's tunnel. In 1838, he did that. And again, it's a tunnel that can be walked today from end to end, bringing water from that spring into the pool of Siloam within the walls. Now, I want to give you a kind of a map of this, where you can see basically what was done. The city of David, Jerusalem, is higher in the eastern part of the city than down in the western part. And so, as a result of that, because of the elevation of the spring itself, the spring had to be outside the city in order for the city to be protected against siege. Now, as it goes down, you'll notice there is a picture of the walls of the city, for example, right here, with regard to it, and even down here, the walls of the city, which are just as high as the walls up on this part. And so they're just as impregnable, or maybe not as much, but they were effective with regard to a siege as well, to withstand that siege that anyone would bring. The problem would be, number one, stopping up the spring in the sense of it's a gushing spring, of diverting the amount of water away from a location or a place where the Assyrians could utilize it, and instead diverting it into the city where it could be utilized by the people of the city. The Pool of Siloam is in the lower area on the west side of the city of Jerusalem, behind the walls. And you'll notice this, as part of this, he also rebuilt, strengthened the walls, built a wall that was broken, raised up the tower. So basically, he fortified the city in preparation for withstanding the attack of Sennacherib. And as a part of this, we were told that he diverted the water. And this is the way that he did it. And the tunnel is actually a tunnel that is not straight. And it's believed that there is a fissure in the rock, that some believe that they were following a fissure in the rock, and that's kind of the reason why it was. It's interesting when you look at the way in which the tunnel was constructed, that the idea is that they started at each end. There's an inscription that I'll show you in just a moment, and they basically kind of worked their way to the middle. And how in the world are you going to meet in the middle? That would be kind of a difficult thing. And while there may have been an actual fissure to help in that regard, in actuality, when you get there, you kind of have to make a hard right turn in order to match them up, because they don't meet in the middle exactly. They weren't able to get it quite that precisely. So when you get to the point where they met, there is a passage where you have to make kind of a 90-degree turn from one to the other to connect them. But they believed that probably the way they did it was acoustically. That basically they were pounding on the rock above, and they were following it that way to go through. But it's in bedrock. It's hard to imagine how difficult it would have been to do that tunnel. There were other tunnels. I don't know if they mentioned it. For example, there were previous tunnels that were built that were hewn out of rock as well. You notice these up here. Going down to the spring, they were simply means of, when you're behind the wall, to go down and get the water and bring it back up. And the rock there was not nearly as dense and hard to dig as Hezekiah's tunnel. But it was believed for a long period of time until this one was discovered that that was probably what they were referring to when they referred to it as God stuff. It turned out it was a much more extensive project that Hezekiah underwent. Now, how do we know that this is the tunnel that Hezekiah built or had dug? Well, one, we have the biblical text which corroborates in detail what was being done and how it was accomplished. The second thing we have are a number of physical evidences. For example, the date of the digging has been confirmed as being about 8th century B.C., which is about the time Hezekiah's reign. Ask, well, how do you do that? Well, what they were able to do is to take the disturbed carbon-based materials, which were the plants that were disturbed in the digging. There are plenty of evidence of, you know, digging through and taking the samples and carbon dating the samples of vegetation with regard to that. And so it's carbon-14 dating that's been used, as well as uranium, thorium dating of stalactites and stalagmites that were formed since the digging of the tunnel. In other words, there are certain places, and everybody knows how stalactites and stalagmites are formed through the dripping of water and the mineralization. The minerals in the water, they form stalactites and stalagmites. Well, after the tunnel was built, those things have been forming. And they're able to date those as well as to being from that time. And then the final one, is it already? I didn't have enough material here. And the final one is the analysis of the writing on the inscription that was found in the mouth of the tunnel at one end, which is referred to as the Siloam inscription. When they analyze the ancient writing of the Siloam inscription, it is in style something that was characteristic of that particular age period. And so there is some pretty strong evidences that indicate that this tunnel was indeed built during the time that Hezekiah reigned as king. There are, by the way, abundant secular sources to indicate that Hezekiah indeed was reigning in Judah at the time of Sennacherib's campaigns against the peoples round about during the Assyrian kingdom. So we'll look at that actually as we get into continual discussion next week. Okay, so now, the Siloam inscription that was found in the tunnel. Tunnel was uncovered in 1838. A lot of junk on the walls. and so there wasn't much that was noted. I think that in 1880, someone found this, basically it's a plaque that was put up on the wall. And the plaque cannot be read in its entirety. You'll notice that there is a break. The position. Now, it wasn't always broken. When they discovered it, it wasn't broken. It was fully intact. But in 1891, Muslims came and took it, broke it, and taking it, they took it, and it was found, and it was reassembled, and there's one piece missing. Now, most of it can be read, but not all of it can be read. And actually, is now in the Istanbul Archaeology Museum, and Israel has asked that it be returned. And Istanbul, they say, no, this is an important relic and has national significance and you can't have it. But they did allow it to be put on display for a period of time. So we stole it and we're not giving it back. You can borrow it. There's a lot of that kind of stuff that goes on with regard to archaeology and such as far as the ancient relics. But it's kind of an interesting thing. There is a replica inscription that can be found there in the tunnel, and what it basically does is describe the construction. It's an inscription that said basically they started at each end and went to the middle. And there is an indication in the wording; it's kind of difficult to understand, but there may be that there's at least an indication maybe that the acoustic method was used that we alluded to earlier. But it does indicate not only the general length of the tunnel in cubits, but also the fact that it was 100 cubits below the ground. So, can you imagine actually doing the digging of that? And as workers utilizing the tools that they used at that time, what it must have been like. It doesn't surprise me that it's only shoulder width apart. You don't want to, if it's bedrock, you don't want to make it any wider than you have to get the water to come through it. But it has to be wide enough for a man to go through it. So it's pretty interesting in that regard. Okay, so anyway, that's just an example of the type of archaeological finds that have come up through the years that that serve to corroborate the biblical text and what the Bible has to say. This is a minor one. It's a pretty interesting one and interactive, because you can actually go and you can walk the entirety of the tunnel if you mind to do it. The other thing that's kind of interesting about it is that it follows a precise grade of about 0.6%. And I'm not exactly sure how they accomplished that, other than I guess maybe using a little bit of arithmetic and a long string. I don't know, but they were able to do that, and it's almost a constant grade from the spring of Gihon down to Siloam's pool. And so it flows that direction. And again, the spring still wells up today, and the water still runs along the bottom of the tunnel. Okay? Interesting. All right. Comments, questions? We just got a minute left. Yes, Kyle.
Real quick, I have no memory on this report other than NBC about 15 years ago, something like that, and they were gathering evidence of Noah's Ark. And it was on the internet that took a picture from about a mile or two upwards to the top, a snapshot, and they enlarged the photo and the appears to be the ark.
Yeah, we'll actually talk about that a little bit, Noah's Ark. To be honest, I don't know that we can locate the mountain, much less the ark. I recognize there are individuals who have made those claims. Some of those claims have been debunked as well. So.
The inscription was the providence of God that we have it today.
The inscription?
Right. I mean, why they...
Well, I don't know that we should necessarily ascribe any particular...
We have our proofs.
Yeah, we have proofs. And yeah, we've got abundance of proofs supplied through archaeological means. But again, you know, this is a natural thing as well. In other words, Hezekiah did something, and this something is such a significant thing, it's not surprising that we would still have evidence of it. I think it is somewhat surprising we walked through it, but that it's still there and that we've been able to locate it is not particularly surprising. It's something that would be naturally something we would look for in this regard. But it does, it's just an example of something that corroborates a biblical text. Now, the other thing we're going to talk about next week, and then we'll go on to other things. But the other thing that talks about Sennacherib is actually not from a biblical source. This is actually King Sennacherib is talking about his battles and his campaigns and how he actually named Hezekiah and describes the siege of Jerusalem in his annals that were recovered with this particular thing. It's called the Taylor Prism, about 15 inches tall, 5 inches wide. A little small thing, but it has 6 panels, and it's really an interesting thing. So we'll talk a little bit about that, which corroborates certain aspects of the narrative that we've read, and we'll continue to read in verses 9 and following in 2 Chronicles 32. Okay? All right, so we'll pick up there with the Taylor Prism next week. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today.